Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's the 30th of September 2020. And the question I want to ask in this podcast is, what is fascism? And this is the first of what promises to be a number of podcasts on the matter of fascism. I imagine there'll be at least one other and maybe two others. And I'll speak about what they are going to be concerned with towards the end. So what's behind the asking of this question? Well, the matter of fascism is very much in the air at the moment. And this against the background of alarming developments in the context of the COVID-19 global pandemic and an associated economic crisis, on top of an underlying economic crisis, on top of a global ecological crisis, and on the top of cultural breakdown and fragmentation in many, many parts of the globe. An example of the question of fascism. The presidential debate which took place in the US yesterday between Joe Biden and Donald Trump on American TV, and which was viewed by many millions of US citizens. It's been remarked that Biden didn't condemn Antifa enough. Trump has already tweeted and made it plain that he believes that Antifa is a terrorist organisation. Antifa, incidentally, just stands for anti-fascist, and it's a movement rather than an organisation. Now, just to get the picture clear, Nigel Farage appears on Twitter the day after, chiding Biden for not condemning Antifa and just treating it as an idea or a set of ideas, when in fact, according to Farage, ostensibly, Antifa is a domestic terrorist organisation. So an anti-fascist movement is a terrorist organisation. So the whole question comes up, well, what is Antifa against? What is the fascism that it's against? So there's a secondary question that's going the rounds, that you hear a lot. And many commentators commentate on it. And Anna and myself have been questioning this matter for quite a long time, in quite a bit of detail. And that question is, can the US and the UK go fascist? And of course, you could apply it further afield if you wanted to. But I'm just going to confine myself to the US and the UK just to make the topic manageable. The question then of what is fascism? It invites a definition of fascism. But I would say that the term evades definition in the very strict sense of supplying sets of necessary and sufficient conditions. It's applied too widely. And the word fascist can just simply be used as an insult. Somebody seems to have a bit of an authoritarian character or just an unpleasant character. You might call them a fascist. So I'm not going to aim for definition in the very strict sense of the word definition. What I'm going to do in part one is actually look at historically occurring fascism, by which I mean Italian fascism, which named itself fascism, and German Nazism. And I don't think anybody's going to argue that both of these regimes and the tactics that these regimes used and the underpinning ideas associated with these regimes, and even perhaps the character types associated with these regimes and the aspirations associated with these regimes can legitimately be called fascist. This is just a very solid usage of the word that we're not going to argue with, most of us. So we're talking about the regime in Italy from, I don't know, about the early 1920s till the end of World War II. 1945, and then in Germany, the 30s, the early 30s, and Hitler's rise. With Hitler being declared Führer in 1934 and finishing in the end of the war in 1945 and Hitler's suicide. Mussolini, incidentally, was killed by Italian partisans by machine gun fire. And his body was hung upside down by the feet. From the girders of a service station somewhere in Milan. So I'm going to examine those historical occurrences, which are very complex, and pull out some really obvious, prominent features. And regarding these prominent features, you'll find that various pundits ascribe them to fascism. Sometimes emphasising this one and sometimes emphasising that one, according to their bent and their underpinning presuppositions. So I've got quite a range of these tendencies. I think there might be about 9 or 10 or something like that. I've got 11 tendencies that I identify, and then I'm going to describe and give some examples from the history where I can, briefly. And then I'm going to go through them again and see if we can find those tendencies in the current state of affairs, politically, culturally, in the US and the UK. And I suppose you could kind of say that this approach might help us to identify fascism or emerging fascism as you know, the possibility for a regime, or as an underpinning set of ideas, or as tactics, or as character types, or as aspirations. We get quite a lot of these features identified, it's more like a tick box regime. Apparently, the way that depression is diagnosed is that there's a number of criteria. I don't know what it is, maybe it's 10 criteria. And if you've got 4, you're depressed. If you've got 3, you're not depressed. And of course, one can always ask, why not 2, why not 5? Why this, and there's a kind of an arbitrariness to it. And it's because we don't have strict definitions. But nevertheless, I think this is a kind of a useful exercise. So firstly, I identify the feature of totalitarianism. The regimes in question were totalitarian. We could identify a regime that was tending towards totalitarianism but hadn't kind of fully made the journey yet. And nevertheless, totalitarianism would be celebrated in the underpinning ideologies and discourses that are behind a movement to establish a fascist state, a fascist regime in a country. So a totalitarian society has an all-powerful one-party state, and there's generally a cult of the leader. This was certainly true of Hitler and Mussolini. And there's a celebration of hierarchy and obedience. So there's the all-powerful leader at the top, then some underlings and some inner circle, and underneath that, the mass of the people. And there's obedience all the way down the line. The second tier has to obey the leader, and the third tier obeys the second tier, and so on. So that the mass actually is sort of regimented, and there's a doctrine of obedience is propagated. Now, Mussolini was big on propagating this in the education system. He really wanted to produce obedient children, and there was a youth movement with military uniforms and marching and regimentation and drill and weapons to militarise the youth, in other words, to make them very regimented and very obedient. Same thing in Nazi Germany, of course, with Hitler Youth. Start them early and inculcate this ethos of obedience. And that all that fits with totalitarianism. It's a complex. You have totalitarian state, all powerful, one party, and both Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy ended up as one party states through political shenanigans and manipulation and all the rest of it. I suggest that to get into the detail of the political shenanigans and the manipulations and the dirty tricks and the violence and the intimidation, it is very well worth reading up on the history of both fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. I'm not going to go into very much detail of that here because it would, because there are specialists who can do that really well, and B, because it would, these podcasts would be hours and hours long. But the way, the unfolding of these stories is very detailed and intricate and with lots of twists and turns. But I recommend that you try and get a grip on it, and it's fascinating and scary, and there are many parallels with what's going on there. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the second feature, and that's violence. Violence is celebrated and used, it's employed politically by fascist regimes, and the ones in question, Italy and Germany, very much so. In Italy, there were assassinations. At least one socialist deputy was beaten to death, and I believe in the presence of his family. There was press who opposed Mussolini's power grab were hunted down and beaten to death. There was just a lot of nasty violence. Fascists are generally ruthless. You know, it's not synonymous with any kind of gentleness or any kind of reasonableness or any kind of even-handedness or anything like that. It's violent, and violence is celebrated and employed politically. And of course, that means war as well. Both Germany and Italy were very aggressive. Germany's first excursion into the Sudetenland was just an invasion. Italy quelled rebellion in its colony, Libya, and they employed poison gas and torture and rape, and it was incredibly violent. Then they invaded Abyssinia, Ethiopia, bombed civilians. It's some of the first aerial bombing in the world. Used poison gas, mustard gas, and phosgene. Yeah, and 500,000 Ethiopians were killed in that. It was a war of conquest. It was a part of the grab for Africa, you might say. But Mussolini wanted to make his mark as a conqueror. So violence celebrated. I mean, in Germany, the rise to power of the Nazis was through elections. Hitler got elected and formed coalitions. And I don't think he ever really got a good majority, but he got into the Bundestag. And there's a lot of street violence at election times and other times with armed militias. The political parties had armed militias. A lot of fighting between the communists and the left and the fascists. And deaths and intimidation through beatings and so on. So they got these paramilitary militias alongside these political parties. And it was a part of the tactic. A third feature is that these movements and the regimes that issue from the movements are born out of economic crisis and also humiliation, out of a cultural crisis as well, which is one of national humiliation. Both Germany and Italy at the time of the rise of the fascist parties in those countries were in dire economic straits. Both had been humiliated as a result of World War One, even though they were on opposite sides. Germany was on the losing side and was bankrupted by reparations for the war. In other words, Germany was made to pay for the war at the Treaty of Versailles, which wrecked the economy. It was already wrecked, but it kind of wrecked it further. And the country was full of humiliated veterans who'd come home from the war. many of them wounded and so forth. Hitler amongst them. Hitler was gassed in the war, lost his sight. He did return, but he lost his sight through being gassed. And I believe he had a bullet wound or a shrapnel wound somewhere. Actually, similar in Italy, but though Italy was on the side of the France and the UK and the US, it didn't come out very well out of the war. The battles that they fought, they tended to lose. And promises were made to the soldiers of land and franchise. They got the franchise, but they didn't get the land. So there was a lot of resentment, and Italy felt humiliated because Italy itself had been promised land by the other allies in return for joining the war, and they didn't get it. They were going to get chunks of Austria, they thought. They didn't. So there was a feeling of national humiliation in both of these places. Terrible unemployment, terrible cultural malaise as well, to do with the outcome of the awful First World War. And the political violence, you can see quite easily how that would arise out of that situation of desperation in these societies. As you could see, would be the rise of communism and socialism and left ideas and trade unionism, which of course did happen. The economically desperate working class did see that there was some hope in a revolution. And bear in mind that in 1917, not so far in the past, that Russia had fallen to a communist revolution. All right, the next feature is that fascism ideologically, and actually when a fascist regime comes about, is undemocratic. And this follows from the hierarchical nature of the kind of societies it produces, and from the celebration of hierarchy and strong leaders and that whole complex that we've just alluded to. Which said that, Hitler was elected, and there was various ups and downs in his electoral career, which I advise you to look into. I'm not going to go into it here, but I advise you to look into it. But he was elected, how he became the Führer was that in 1934 there was a referendum on whether the roles of the President of Germany and the Chancellor of Germany could be held by the same person. And the idea being that Hitler would hold both of these offices, and this would enable him to address through unlimited executive power the crisis that the country was in, the emergency that it was in. And something along these lines had already happened. There had been emergency powers had been enacted. And the German people did vote in 1934 that Hitler could become the president, i.e. the head of state, and the chancellor, i.e. the prime minister. And he could hold both offices, and this is how he became the Führer, not long after he declared the Führer, the leader. By this time, they had manoeuvred the law so that all other political parties were outlawed. I mean, it came about because Hindenburg died in 1934, the president. And so it created this situation, who's going to be the new president? And Hitler said, well, I'm the chancellor, I'll be the president as well. And the public consented to it. There's a very similar trajectory for Mussolini, but different in detail, different dirty tricks. But I think the lesson here is that whenever democracy is under fire, the little bit of democracy that we've got, notice I always claim that neither the US nor the UK is a real democracy. It has a little bit of democracy. But when that little bit of democracy is under threat, you might want to be on the lookout for incipient fascism. Because in both the cases of Mussolini and Hitler and their parties, they gradually whittled away democracy over a period of years in the various parliaments and through I say, through very nefarious means, cheating, until both Italy and Germany became one-party states. I think Italy was a one-party state sometime in the early 20s, and Germany definitely by 34, when Hitler became the Führer. So the next feature is fascism embraces ideas of racial and cultural and or cultural superiority. In Germany, the Aryan Germans were the master race. They had a whole theory of this, and this is how it was expressed. They were the master race. And other people that lived in the German lands or near the German lands, like Slavs, well, Slavs are slaves, actually, is what the word means, and Gypsies and Jews were actually, in the case of Gypsies and Jews, were thought to be subhuman. And there's a whole ideology around this, and the pseudoscience of race science, where you measure people's skulls and tell whether they're racially pure or not, and race laws. And of course, we've seen this in more recent times in South Africa. But certainly in Germany, if you wanted to marry somebody, you've got to prove that neither of you were Jews, back to your grandparents or something like that. There's some kind of like intricate Baroque sets of laws, all based on this pseudo-race science. But this is very, very common. Interestingly, and this is a very interesting difference between Italy and Germany, that we can draw some conclusions about fascism from this difference, which I will do perhaps later on, not necessarily in this podcast. But this very interesting difference is that Italy, initially at least, wasn't anti-Semitic. The Italian fascists weren't anti-Semites. There were Jews in the party. One estimate is that one in three Jews joined the fascist party. Some of them were very enthusiastic about it. Mussolini's mistress was Jewish. I mean, later, as Mussolini came more and more under the spell of Hitler, they did start to persecute Jews and throw them out of the party and so forth. And then in the latter part of World War II, when the Germans basically took over the northern half of Italy, because the Italians by now were having a civil war and half of them were fighting for the Allies, and because the Italian king had said Italy's changing sides, Italy had a king throughout all this, so the Germans occupied the northern half. And when they occupied Rome in 1943, they rounded up many thousands of Jews and shipped them off to the camps, 1943. So there's a bit of a story around anti-Semitism in Italy that's rather different from the way all that panned out in Germany. The sort of quintessence here is otherisation. And that's a mechanism, an ideological manoeuvre or an ideological mechanism for dividing and ruling a people, and for creating solidarity and uniformity amongst the people by having an enemy to focus any resentments on. And there was a lot of resentment in both of these countries due to the economic deprivation and the demoralisation as a result of the outcomes of World War One. So otherisation, in the case of the Germans, it was the Jews. Let's focus our hatred on the Jews and the Gypsies and the degenerate artists and the communists and the people that are not into belonging to our folk, our people, our uniform, conformist people. And obviously, if you've got this agenda of conformity, producing conformity, so that you can actually mobilise the economic forces of a society, so you can place it on a war footing very easily, a good way to do that is to have some categories of identity around which to produce that uniformity, around which to organise that uniformity. And a part of that is to define the in-group against out-groups. hence the scapegoating of the Jews. There was plenty of anti-Semitism prior Hitler. Anti-Semitism had been around in Europe for hundreds of years. What Hitler did was mobilise it to produce this uniform society which he could militarise and which he could mobilise very effectively the productive forces of that population in that way. In Italy, a bit different, because they didn't otherwise the Jews. And what they did, of course, was to focus on what was actually a real threat to their ideas and their setup and to capitalism in Italy, which was the communists. And there was a huge communist movement growing up in Italy. And, I mean, to get your head round this, understand, to get your head round this, consider something like the way in which Mussolini's fascists wrecked the trade union headquarters in Turin in the run-up to their taking of complete power. Another feature is a kind of local utopianism, which we call nationalism. And this is a part of the otherisation process. And of course, people can be made to rally around the flag and around identity fairly easily. It's a tendency that both Hitler and Mussolini exploited. And fascism is always fervently nationalistic. The next one, and I think this is probably the really crucial one, is that fascism is always right-wing economically. It always champions capitalism. It won't have any truck with communism. Communism is the real enemy of fascism. Or socialism, or anything left, trade unionism, socialism, workers' self-organisation, and the internationalism that tends to go along with that. You know, workers of the world, unite. You've nothing to lose but your chains. That idea is anathema to nationalistic, one-party, strong leader styles of social organisation. So it always favours big capital. And you could argue that fascism is a response to the rise of the left in response to a catastrophic crisis such as existed in Italy and Germany in the 20s and 30s. Naturally, people turned to communism. There was some hope in there. And there was the example of the Soviet Union, very distant in time or space particularly. So there was a lure of communism. This was obviously scared the shit out of the big capitalists and the financiers and the industrialists in both of these countries. And they would actually back anybody who they thought could face down this advancing communism. And the fascists were quite willing to do that in street brawls, in gunfights on the streets, in assassinations and in intimidation and violence. And Hitler's campaigns to further the cause of his party in German democratic politics, in the German Bundestag, were financed by big business, by big financiers and industrialists and agricultural capital as well, put money into him. And I believe Mussolini too got plenty of backing from his local big capital. And note in this context that some of the first people that Hitler sent for extermination at the camps, at the concentration camps, were leftists, trade unionists, communists, German leftists. And both regimes outlawed trade unions or broke them up and so forth. One of the stories that fascists tell about this endeavour to face down communism and to ensure capitalist organisation in economics is that they are saving civilisation. I'm going to give you a quote here from Goebbels, Dr. Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister, a prominent Nazi. In 1935, Dr. Goebbels said, "The Bolshevik threat is against families, civilisation, Christianity. I'd just like to throw this in the works as well. It's a more recent quotation from Charlie Kirk, the guy who bankrolls Turning Point, a sort of far-right movement in the US, which has got a branch in the UK called Turning Point UK, which is pretty lame and dumb, I have to say, but there's a lot of money behind it. Charlie Kirk's the guy. This is the quote. Trump was elected to defend our families from the vengeful mob that seeks to destroy our way of life, our schools, neighbourhoods, churches and values. Trump is the bodyguard of Western civilization. So this is a common fascist theme. They're saving civilization from communism. One of the ways this narrative was further mobilised was in Hitler's conspiracy theory. Hitler propagated a conspiracy theory that the world was going to be destroyed by a Jewish Bolshevik conspiracy. So it's conflating Jews, you know, and thereby mobilising the perennial European anti-Semitism, undercurrent of anti-Semitism, with Bolshevism, the philosophy of the Russians. And whether Hitler believed that or not, I don't know. I think he probably did. It doesn't make a lot of sense, doesn't bear a lot of historical examination, even though the theory still has still got mileage in it, and among far-right groups, particularly US far-right groups, it's still kind of current. Now, so I did say that, you know, Hitler got lots of corporate funding for his game. And the Krupps and the Messerschmitt and so forth were going to make profits from a war footing. Plus, putting the country on a war footing, rearming the country, was going to create loads and loads of jobs and actually mobilise the economy and give it some dynamics and basically rescue the economy by getting the whole country on a war footing and then actually having a war, invading Sudeten land and then invading Poland and precipitating World War II. We should mention that both Hitler and Mussolini put quite a bit of resources and their ability to mobilise the productive capacity of society into public works, roads and so forth. And you can almost see like this war footing that both countries went on to was a kind of New Deal. You know, it was a pump priming the economy by public works. So you say, well, okay, capitalism was going to do pretty well out of it because the economy was re-galvanised. And you should note that capitalism will get in bed with just about anybody. There is no necessary link between capitalism and democracy. They'll get in bed with anybody if they think they can keep making profits and if the government will make decisions that are in their favour. It's interesting in this vein that Mussolini actually characterised fascism as the complete entanglement of corporations and the state. Corporate power and state power become just completely mixed up. And I'm going to run with that definition, Mussolini's own definition, in part two, in other words, in a follow-up to this podcast. Here is a quote from Mussolini where he encapsulates that notion. Quote, everything inside the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state. So summing this section up, the section on the right-wing nature of fascist economies, I do take it pretty seriously that fascism is a response to the threat of revolution or to the threat of socialist advances. And without that threat and without those socialist advances, it probably wouldn't occur quite the way it does. I think there would still be authoritarian regimes. They're kind of pretty ancient, pretty venerable. And this explains why fascism is never a very coherent ideology. It's not a coherent political philosophy. It's something rather opportunistic. And ideas are sort of bolted on without much regard for consistency or much regard for truth in an expedient way. And that's why you will find differences between different fascisms. And that's why it wasn't necessary for Mussolini to adopt anti-Semitism. He didn't like Hitler's race ideas. Anyway. So, okay, the next one. We've kind of touched on this. And it's social uniformity or social conformity. So the next feature is social conformity. Fascism really needs social conformity. And this is why it eliminates the other. And this is why it educates children in a way that endeavours to make them very conformist. And explains the youth movements and so forth, and again, both in Italy and in Germany. And the idea is to produce a uniform mass. If you listen to these podcasts, you will have heard me say on numerous occasions, you know, the mob haunts politics. Politics is haunted by the mob. And this is what this is about. It's to produce a controllable mass that can be mobilised, both in terms of economic production, industrial production in society, and can be mobilised for war purposes, for purposes of conquest and aggrandisement of the state, the nation, the all-important nation. No doubt with the ability to grab resources and enslave populations thrown in as a bonus. So there's an enormous move towards mass conformity. I don't think it's too far-fetched to think that people really wanted this in general. You know, there was a large appetite for this. It wasn't a uniform, because there were communists who wanted something different and leftists who wanted something different. But it affected a large swathe of the population. And I would say that was a direct consequence of the demoralisation, of the feeling of national shame because of the outcomes of World War One and cultural inertia as well that rose out of that. So there would be an appetite for that sort of conformity, for that authority, for the strong man to come and save us. If you want to get psychoanalytic about this, say, well, it's daddy. Fall into the arms of daddy. Daddy's going to save you. And if you see movies of Mussolini addressing the crowds. He addressed huge crowds from the balconies in Rome and various cities. Huge crowds, and they're hysterical with adoration and losing themselves in the mass. There's like a touch of the Dionysian in there. Community solidarity through loss of self into an intense emotional experience. Experience in a crowd, in a huge crowd. And he was the master at manipulating those kind of emotions. Hitler, the same. And of course, Hitler had people like Leni Riefenstahl and Albrecht Speer, who were masters at the way light and colour and parades and movement and regimentation influenced people emotionally and how it could work on their subconscious minds. And the staged rallies, huge crowds being subjected to Hitler's demagoguery. And again, he was very good at it. Obviously, the other part of the equation, again, is the willingness of the people to swallow this stuff, to take it in, to be seduced by the emotion that is produced. But nevertheless, it works, and we do see it going on in various parts of the world at the very moment. Now, there is the thing about fascism that ties in with this, that it does emphasise society and mass consciousness, the nation, the folk, the people, rather than individuality. It asks people to submerge their individuality into the mass, into the people, into the greater good of the nation. There's a lot of discourses like that. And this is why Hitler called this thing National Socialism. It was nothing to do with socialism, but it was to do with producing a mass society in which the individual didn't really count, only in the most minor way, that the greater good was the mass. But of course this was a production on the part of the ruling few, and it was produced through propaganda means and through spectacle, through demagoguery, and through cashing in on the very real despair that arose out of the crises, economic, cultural, etc., that were unfolding at that time. But certainly there's nothing socialist about Nazism, except the word. You know, socialism is anti-capitalism, and this particular kind of mass society is very, very pro-capitalism, and it rescued capitalism from the threat of socialism and communism, which was very real at that time. The next feature is the use of propaganda, and I've just mentioned that, and the use of dirty tricks. And I suggest you do look the history up. There's plenty of good videos on YouTube, there's stuff on Wikipedia, but there are many, many great books by great historians. It's worth getting a number of sources so you can get to the bottom of this. But I recommend that. And you can see that the dirty tricks was just off the scale to get both Mussolini and Hitler in positions of absolute power through their respective parliaments and through other means, obviously, propaganda, intimidation, violence, and so on. So I just suggest, rather than me going into a long diatribe about the Reichstag fire and Mussolini's march on Rome, that I'll leave that to you, and I think you'll find it pretty fascinating. I would almost say it's essential to get acquainted with what went on at that time. A big part of it, of course, is lies, 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 lies and lies. You know, there's no concept of truth is given any kind of truck or any kind of moral weight in fascism, certainly as it was instantiated by these two regimes and their various tactics and underpinning ideas. All right, next one is socially conservative. Now, fascism is always officially socially conservative. You saw that in the Goebbels quote, family, Christianity. But the inner circle can be very amoral. It's one rule for them and another rule for the mass. But as far as the mass was concerned, they wanted good behaviour, uniform behaviour. So they were into the family and so forth. And they weren't beyond utilising religion in this respect. And now in the case of Mussolini, this is an interesting little story. He wanted the Pope to use his authority in a Catholic country, where most people were reasonably devout Catholics, to take Mussolini's side and to get behind him. So the Pope did a deal with Mussolini. And he said, well, we'll support you. The Catholic Church will support you if you give us Vatican City. Because at that time, Vatican City wasn't an independent state. It was a part of Italy. So Mussolini let the Pope have Vatican City as an independent city-state, which it still is, in return for the Pope speaking up for Mussolini. The Pope actually said, quote, Mussolini is sent by divine providence. I don't know if you've heard where you've heard that before, but evangelicals in the US believe that Donald Trump has been sent by God to save America and the world. Secondarily, America first, world next. And this brings me to the next point, which is that fascism is almost always suffused with big dollops of irrationalism. And that is one, the idea that Donald Trump is sent by God, or that Mussolini was sent by God, is a purely, purely irrational belief, which nevertheless can get some traction with populations of devout Catholics or evangelical Christians. And there is a real big thread of irrationalism through fascism. And this is because it's not a coherent political philosophy. There isn't anything equivalent to the works of Marx, which is a big shelf full of very, very rigorous, very closely researched, very sophisticated analysis. There's nothing equivalent to that in fascism. There's a few attempts which I've dealt with in previous podcasts. If you go back, you'll find a podcast about the contrast between ethno-nationalism and cosmopolitanism and the use of Heideggerian notions, particularly from the Black Notebooks, to try and work up some philosophy that justifies ethno-nationalism. And there's some kind of PhD type people doing that, but it's kind of not great stuff from where I can see. Certainly, you know, there is no coherent fascist philosophy. And this is because its elements are really bolted together through opportunism, which is why different fascisms can look quite different, as is, you know, as with the case of the Italian Jews joining the fascist party, but German Jews being rounded up and killed by fascists. And this leads us to expect that the surface appearance of fascisms can be very, very different. And we need to bear that in mind when we appraise the question of whether the US and the UK are on a fascist trajectory or not. The appearance doesn't have to be like Nazi Germany in the 30s or fascist Italy in the 20s. It doesn't have to be. But there is an embrace of irrationalism within fascism. It's almost as though rationality was a taint on the fighting spirit or on the community spirit. And remember, it attempts to engender that feeling of solidarity amongst an ethnicity and a nation. It's very uniform. There's like a deliberate attempt to produce that through emotional states manipulated through rallies and chanting and marching and in the education system. It's emotional manipulation and formation of the unconscious parts of people's psyches. So you get the conspiracy theories, you know, the Jewish Bolshevik conspiracy and the protocols of the Elders of Zion and so forth. They're quite irrational. They're not true. And they're just, people get heated up about them because they fit, which is a kind of, a feature of rationality is that we look for fit when we look for pattern, but there's also a feature of irrationality that we find fit, that suits us. It's kind of pareidolia is a real part of the human situation, but it goes both ways. And the pseudoscience of Nazi Germany, which is complete pseudoscience, very, very irrational, but made to look like science. And of course, the Nazis thought, you know, the inner Nazis, some of them, they followed astrology and they'd got astrologers. And they thought that, you know, there were flying saucers in the centre of the earth that came out through a hole at the North Pole and all kinds of stuff like that. This climate of despair and this whipping up of emotion and fervour and playing on some of the dark forces within humanity just produces an atmosphere and a soil, if you like, in which irrationalism flourishes. So I'm just going to summarise that. Just see what we've got. So these are the features: totalitarianism, violence. Fascism tends to arise out of crisis, particularly economic crisis, but also mass psychological crisis. It's undemocratic. Generally tries to dismantle democracy and produce a one-party state and one leader, one strong leader. And a cult of the leader is a very common feature. Ideas of racial and or cultural superiority thrive and are mobilised to produce a solidarity through otherisation and scapegoating of people outside of the in-group. Alongside this, of course, nationalism as a part of it and a feature. Always right-wing economically, and it seems to me almost parasitic upon any kind of rise of socialist or communist or leftist ideas and leftist mobilisation that actualises in trade unions and gains, political gains. I think that's very, very central to all this. You know, fascism is a response of capitalism, or at least fostered by capitalism, to threats from communism and socialism and the associated ideas and understandings. And also social uniformity and conformity is a part of it. Again, it's necessary to the power dynamic of this kind of setup. And then the use of propaganda is common, and dirty tricks. There's no morality. There's no aversion to dirty tricks, rigging, false flags, intimidation, including assassination. And socially conservative, officially, was probably amoral in the inner circle for reasons of social solidarity. And irrational, having a big, big dollop of irrationality. Okay, so my plan was actually now to go through those, I think there's 11 points, 11 features, and see if we can identify the beginnings of them or the presence of them in our current situation in the US and in the UK. But I'm coming up towards an hour now, so I'm going to do that as part two. And very shortly, probably tomorrow. So it looks like there's going to be four parts to this. There'll be a second part on checking out these features against our current situation. And then a part which takes a completely different look at fascism through Mussolini's idea of the entanglement of corporate and state power. And just look through a few examples there. Again, without going too heavily on the historical detail, because you can have some fun sorting that out for yourself, but I'll point you in the direction. So I fancy doing that for number three. And for number four, I'm going to explore this idea that fascism is the weaponisation of the death instinct. And this will be more to do with character formations and what kind of character is formed by fascism, and what kind of character falls for fascism, and how the fascist project manifests through individuals and through individuals' psyche. Okay, thanks for listening, and thanks to the few patrons who bung us a few quid, which pay for the space, and I'm able to buy a nice microphone as well with some of that money. And if you know anybody who'd like to bung us a couple of dollars, see if you can get them on board and see if you can spread this around a little bit. I would like people to hear our analyses and be stimulated by them and possibly irritated by them. Either is just good. So over and out, and lots of love, and make knowledge great again.